Okay, welcome back. So, did I mention that both Mitchell and Ben have books for sale right over there, along with the new issue of River Styx, the games issue? You should get your grubby mitts on because it's a really good issue. And at this point, I'm going to bring up to the podium our very own Shani Latham. She's our managing editor. This is her debut in front of you all, and we love her so, and you all will too.
Okay. And I was tasked with the honor of introducing Ben Percy because I'm the resident fiction writer and because I inherited his desk as a graduate assistant at SIU a year or so after he left. And SIU is actually the first place that I saw him read in 2005. It was my first year in that program and about a year after he graduated. And he was already becoming a bit of a legend. And one of the things that I heard about his work before I had read it was that he writes sort of what I'd call manly stories, right? There are usually guns and animals that have antlers, and there's wilderness and there's blood, and that I think does accurately portray at least one surface level of Ben's stories. But what I later discovered as I actually began to read them for myself is that they're appealing universally to those who maybe don't know much about the animals and the antlers and all of that because of the human qualities that his characters have, because they all share the same emotional struggles that we do with their families, with their parents, their lovers, their friends, and fears that we have that, as one of his narrators says, many terrible things can happen to people when they're least expecting it. And he does put his characters in mortal peril from time to time. And though some of those external struggles his characters face may be foreign to us, the internal struggles that they face aren't. And I think that sort of the universality of that is what has led to his success. The title story of his second collection, Refresh, Refresh, which I think he might be reading tonight, was received an award from the Paris Review, their Plimpton Prize. It received a pushcart. And it was selected by Ann Patchett for Best American Stories 2006. It was adapted into a graphic novel, which is for sale tonight, along with the book itself. And he's also had, he had an essay in 2007 listed in the 100 Notable and Best American Essays, two more stories in the 100 Distinguished and Best American Short Stories, and in 2008 won a Whiting Writers Award from the Whiting Foundation. He's a regular contributor to both Poets and Writers and Esquire. He's an assistant professor in the MFA program at Iowa State, as well as on the faculty of the low-res MFA program at Pacific University. He has a novel forthcoming this year from Grey Wolf Press called The Wilding, and what looks to be about a collection's worth of stories in numerous magazines and journals over the course of the year. I don't know where he finds the time to also travel and read, but since he has, we'll bring him up here, Ben Percy.
Thanks so much for that introduction, and thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. It's a pleasure to be here to see some old friends, meet some new ones, and share the stage with Mitchell. Listening to those poems, it's impossible not to snap your fingers and stomp your feet a little. Well done. I'm going to read for a bit from the title story of the collection. I won't bore you with the whole thing. And if you want to know how it turns out, you can wrestle this spittle-soaked, bourbon-soaked copy away from me afterwards. So in particular, I was inspired by an article I read years ago about a small town in Ohio where in one night about a dozen fathers and brothers and sons and uncles were killed in an ambush. This is a small town where just about everyone was part of a National Guard unit. And I grew up in a small town in Oregon, so I transplanted it there and just wondered about the kind of cavity that would leave behind. But in writing about war, I knew that, you know, I couldn't write a story that happened over there. For whatever reason, you can write about outer space if you're not an astronaut, or write about wizards even if you've never cast a spell. But when it comes to war, you know, people want to know that you've worn camis yourself. So I decided to write about the battleground at home. When school let out, the two of us went to my backyard to fight. We were trying to make each other tougher. So in the grass, in the shade of the pines and junipers, Gordon and I slung off our backpacks and laid down a pale green garden hose, tip to tip, making a ring. Then we stripped off our shirts and put on our gold-colored boxing gloves and fought. Every round went 2 minutes. If you stepped out of the ring, you lost. If you cried, you lost. If you got knocked out, or if you yelled stop, you lost. Afterwards, we drank Coca-Colas and smoked Marlboros, our chests heaving, our faces all different shades of blacks and reds and yellows. We began fighting after Seth Johnson, a no-neck linebacker with teeth like corn kernels and hands like T-bone steaks, beat Gordon until his face swelled and split open and purpled around the edges. Eventually, he healed, the rough husks of scabs peeling away to reveal a different face than the one I remembered. Older, squarer, fiercer, his left eyebrow separated by a gummy white scar. It was his idea, fighting each other. He wanted to be ready. He wanted to hurt back those who hurt him. And if he went down, he would go down swinging, as his father would have wanted. This was what we all wanted, to please our fathers, to make them proud, even though they had left us. This happened in Tumalo, Oregon, a high desert town in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. In Tumalo, we have 1,500 people, a Dairy Queen, a BP gas station, a Food for Less, a meatpacking plant, a bright green football field irrigated by canal water, and your standard assortment of taverns and churches. Nothing distinguishes us from Bend or Redmond or Lapine or any of the other nowhere towns off Route 97 except for this. We are home to the 2nd Battalion, 34th Marines. The 50-acre base built in the 1980s is a collection of one-story cinder block buildings interrupted by cheatgrass and sagebrush. Apparently, conditions here in Oregon's ranch country match very closely those of the Middle East, particularly the mountainous terrain of Afghanistan and northern Iraq. And throughout my childhood, I could hear, if I cupped a hand to my ear, the lowing of bulls, the bleating of sheep, the report of assault rifles shouting from the hilltops. Our fathers, Gordon's and mine, were like the other fathers in Tumalo. All of them just about had enlisted as part-time soldiers, as reservists for drill pay. Several thousand a year for a private and several thousand more for a sergeant. Beer pay, they called it, and for 2 weeks every year plus one weekend a month, they trained. They threw on their camis and filled their rucksacks and kissed us goodbye, and then the gates of the 2nd Battalion drew close behind them. Our fathers would vanish into the pine-studded hills, returning to us Sunday night with their faces reddened from weather, with their biceps trembling from fatigue, and their hands smelling of rifle grease. They would use terms like ECP and PRP and MEU and WMD, and they would do push-ups in the middle of the living room, and they would call 6 o'clock 1800 hours, and they would high-five and yell, Semper Fi! And then a few days would pass. And they would go back to the way they were, to the men we knew. Coors drinking, baseball throwing, crotch scratching, aqua velva smelling, fathers. No longer. In January, the battalion was activated, and in March, they shipped off for Iraq. Our fathers, our coaches, our teachers, our barbers, our cooks, our gas station attendants and UPS deliverymen and deputies and firemen and mechanics, our fathers, so many of them, climbed onto the olive green school buses and pressed their palms to the windows and gave us the bravest, most hopeful smiles you can imagine, and vanished, just like that. Nights, I sometimes got on my Honda dirt bike and rode through the hills and canyons of Deschutes County. Beneath me, the engine growled and shuddered, while all around me, the wind, like something alive, bullied me, tried to drag me from my bike. A dark world slipped past as I downshifted, leaning into a turn, and accelerated on a straightaway, my speed 70, then 80, concentrating only on the 20 yards of road glowing ahead of me. On this bike, I could ride and ride and ride away from here, up and over the Cascade Mountains, through the Willamette Valley, until I reached the ocean, where the broad black backs of whales regularly broke the surface of the water, and even farther, farther still, until I caught up with the horizon, where my father would be waiting. Inevitably, I ended up at Hole in the Ground. Many years ago, a meteor came screeching down from space and left behind a crater 5,000 feet wide and 300 feet deep. Hole in the Ground is frequented during the winter by the daredevil sledders among us, and during the summer, by bearded geologists from OSU interested in the metal fragments strewn across its bottom. I dangled my feet over the edge of the crater and leaned back on my elbows and took in the sky. No moon, only stars, just a little lighter black than a crow. Every few minutes a star seemed to come unstuck, streaking through the night in a bright flash that burned into nothingness. In the near distance, the grayish-green glow of Tumalo dampened the sky, a reminder of how close we came so many years ago to oblivion. A chunk of space ice or a solar wind at just the right moment could have jogged that meteor sideways, and rather than landing here, it could have landed there, at the intersection of Maine and Farwell. No Dairy Queen, no Tumalo High. No 2nd Battalion. It didn't take much imagination to realize how something can drop out of the sky and change everything. This was October when Gordon and I circled each other in the backyard after school. We wore our golden boxing gloves, cracked with age and letting off flakes when we pounded them together. Browned grass crunched beneath our sneakers and dust rose in little puffs like distress signals. Gordon was thin to the point of being scrawny. His collarbone poked against his skin like a swallowed coat hanger. His head was too big for his body, and his eyes were too big for his head, and the football players, Seth Johnson among them, regularly tossed him into garbage cans and called him E.T. He had had a bad day, and I could tell from the look on his face, the watery eyes, the trembling lips that revealed in quick flashes his buck teeth, that he needed to hit me. So I let him. I raised my gloves to my face and pulled my elbows against my ribs, and Gordon lunged forward, his arms snapping like rubber bands. I stood still, allowing his fist to work up and down my body, allowing him to throw the weight of his anger on me, until eventually he grew too tired to hit anymore, and I opened up my stance and floored him with a right cross to the temple. He lay there, sprawled out in the grass with a small smile on his E.T. face. "Damn," he said in a dreamy voice. A drop of blood gathered along the corner of his eye and streaked down his temple into his hair. My father wore steel-toed boots, Carhartt jeans, a T-shirt advertising some place he had traveled, maybe Yellowstone or Seattle. He looked like someone you might see shopping for motor oil at Bi-Mart. To hide his receding hairline, he wore a John Deere cap that laid a shadow across his face. His brown eyes blinked above a considerable nose, underlined by a gray mustache. Like me, my father was short and squat, a bulldog. His belly was a swollen bag, and his shoulders were broad, good for carrying me during parades and affairs when I was younger. He laughed a lot. He liked game shows. He drank too much beer and smoked too many cigarettes and spent too much time with his buddies fishing, hunting, bullshitting, which probably had something to do with why my mother divorced him and moved to Boise with a hairdresser slash triathlete named Chuck. At first, when my father left, like all of the other fathers, he would email whenever he could. He would tell me about the heat, the gallons of water he drank every day, the sand that got into everything, the baths he took with baby wipes. He would tell me how safe he was, how very safe. This was when he was stationed in Turkey, then the 2nd Battalion ship for Kirkuk, where insurgents and sandstorms attacked almost daily. The emails came less and less frequently, with weeks of silence between them. Sometimes, on the computer, I would hit refresh, 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 hoping. In October, I received an email that read, "Hi, Josh, I'm okay, don't worry, do your homework, love, Dad." I printed it up and hung it on my door with a piece of scotch tape. For 20 years, my father worked at Nosler Incorporated, the bullet manufacturer based out of Bend, and the Marines trained him as an ammunition technician. Gordon liked to say his father was a gunnery sergeant, and he was, but we all knew he was also the battalion mess manager, a cook, which was how he made his living in Tumalo, tending the grill at hamburger patties. We knew their titles, but we didn't know, not really, what their titles meant, what our fathers did over there. We imagined them doing heroic things, rescuing Iraqi babies from burning huts, sniping suicide bombers before they could detonate on a crowded city street. We drew on Hollywood and Fox News to develop elaborate scenarios where, say, maybe at twilight during a trek through the mountains of northern Iraq, bearded insurgents ambushed our fathers with rocket launchers. We imagined them silhouetted by a fiery explosion. We imagined them burrowing into the sand like lizards and firing their M16s, their bullets streaking through the darkness like the meteorites I observed on sleepless nights. When Gordon and I fought, we painted our faces black and green and brown with the camo grease our fathers left behind. It made our eyes and teeth appear startlingly white, and it smeared away against our gloves, just as the grass smeared away beneath our sneakers, and the ring became a circle of dirt, the dirt, a reddish color that looked a lot like scab flesh. One time, Gordon hammered my shoulders so hard I couldn't lift my arm for a week. Another time, I elbowed him in the kidneys and he peed blood. We struck each other with such force and frequency the golden gloves crumbled and our knuckles showed through the sweat-soaked, blood-soaked foam like teeth through a busted lip. So we bought another set of gloves, and as the air grew steadily colder, we fought with steam blasting from our mouths. Our fathers had left us, but men remained in Tumalo. There were old men, like my grandfather, who I lived with, men who had paid their dues, who had worked their jobs and fought their wars, and now spent their days at the gas station, drinking bad coffee from styrofoam cups, complaining about the weather, arguing about the best months to reap alfalfa. And there were incapable men, men who rarely shaved and watched daytime television in their once white underpants. Men who lived in trailers and filled their shopping carts with Bush Light, summer sausage, Oreo cookies. And then there were vulturous men like Dave Lightner. Men who scavenged whatever our fathers had left behind. Dave Lightner worked as a recruitment officer. I'm guessing he was the only recruitment officer in world history who drove a Vespa scooter with the Support Our Troops ribbon magnet on its rear. We sometimes saw it parked outside the homes of young women whose husbands had gone to war. Dave had big ears and small eyes and wore his hair in your standard issue high and tight buzz. He often spoke in a too loud voice about all the insurgents he'd gunned down when working a Fallujah patrol unit. He lived with his mother in Tumalo, but spent his days in Bend and Redmond trolling the parking lots of Best Buy, Shopko, Kmart, Walmart, Mountain View Mall. He was looking for people like us, people who were angry and dissatisfied and poor. But Dave Leitner knew better than to bother us. On duty, he stayed away from Tumalo entirely. Recruiting there would be too much like poaching the burned section of forest where deer, ribs slatted and wobbly-legged, nose through the ash, seeking something green. We didn't fully understand the reasons our fathers were fighting. We only understood that they had to fight. The necessity of it made the reason irrelevant. "It's all part of the game," my grandfather said. "It's just the way it is." We could only cross our fingers and wish on stars and hit refresh, refresh, hoping they would return to us, praying we would never find Dave Leitner on our porch uttering the words I regret to inform you. One time, my grandfather dropped Gordon and me off at the Mountain View Mall, and there, near the glass-doored entrance, stood Dave Leitner. He wore his creased khaki uniform and spoke with a group of Mexican teenagers. They were laughing, shaking their heads, and walking away from him as we walked toward. We had our hats pulled low, and he didn't recognize us. "Question for you, gentlemen," he said, in the voice of telemarketers and door-to-door Jehovah's Witnesses. "What do you plan on doing with your lives?" Gordon pulled off his hat with a flourish, as if he were part of some ta-da magic act, and his face was the trick. "I plan on killing some crazy-ass Muslims," he said, and forced a smile. "How about you, Josh?" "Yeah," I said. "Kill some people, then get myself killed." I grimaced even as I played along. "That sounds like a good plan." Dave Leitner's lips tightened into a thin line, his posture straightened, and he asked us what we thought our fathers would think, hearing us right now. "They're out there risking their lives, defending our freedom, and you're cracking sick jokes," he said. "I think that's sick." We hated him for his soft hands and clean uniform. We hated him because he sent people like us off to die. Because at 23 he had attained a higher rank than our fathers. Because he slept with the lonely wives of soldiers. And now we hated him even more for making us feel ashamed. I wanted to say something sarcastic, but Gordon was quicker. His hand was out before him, his fingers gripping an imaginary bottle. "Here's your maple syrup," he said. When Dave said, "And what is that for?" Gordon said, "To eat my ass with." Right then, a skateboarder type with green hair and a nose ring walked from the mall, a bag full of DVDs swinging from his fist. And Dave Leitner forgot about us. "Hey, friend," he was saying, "let me ask you something. Do you like war movies?" And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Well, I guess we're done. Goddamn. I was just getting started. Well, I would like to tell you that on February 15th, we'll be featuring our next reading with Major Jackson and Brett Eugene Ralph, so hopefully we'll see you all then. Should be a good reading. And also, I would like to say thank you to Ben Percy and to Mitchell L.H. Douglas for reading with us. And then also, I would like to say thank you to Karen Duffy for letting us do this for 35 years. Unbelievable. Don't forget that both of our writers have books for sale over yonder at that corner. And thank you for coming, and we'll see you next month.